I'm an Al-Anon. Before I start, I have a public amend to make to the city of Omaha and the Paxton Hotel. Albert, as he told you, used to do lots and lots of drinking here. And I remember way back when I used to say to myself, well, if he just didn't go to Omaha and if he just didn't stay at the Paxton Hotel, he wouldn't do that. And you know, I used to believe it about Omaha and Broken Bow and Scott's Bluff. No. Anyway, I am very delighted to be here, and I thank the committee for asking Albert and I to come. It's always just such a treat for me to be invited any place, because there was a lot of times when no one asked me to go any place at all. I remember one time I asked my daughter, why doesn't anybody call me anymore? You know, what's wrong? No one calls me on the phone, no one comes to see me. And Roxy gave me kind of a funny look, and she said, Mama, why should they? Look what you've become. And I didn't understand what she meant, and it took me a long time, even in Al-Anon, to realize, you know, what I had become. So it's a real treat for me to be here. I wish I had a real funny story to tell you. Albert one time said to me when he hadn't been in the program very long, in fact, it was when he was going to give his first talk, he said, tell me some of the funny things that I did when I was drinking. And I said, there was nothing funny that you did when you were drinking. But you know, we had a chance a couple of years ago. We took all of our old 8mm films and we put them on tape for the kids and gave them to them for Christmas. And Albert and I had to go back and we had to edit all those, you know, hundreds of feet of film. And as we would go over them, I'd see, oh, look, that picnic that we went on with the children when they were real small. And that time we took them sliding and when we all learned to ski, you know, and there were some really fun times that we did go, that we did have. And I'm very grateful for that because, you know, I think so many of us, when we get to this program, at least it was for me, and that's the only person I can speak for is myself, everything was really grim. I didn't think there was anything good that had happened in my life, and I realize now that there were lots and lots of good times, and I'm very grateful for those now. I was raised by a mother and father who absolutely adored me, and that's the only way I can put it to you. My daddy was... He used to call me his little punk, and he put me on a pedestal when I was a little tiny girl. He kept me there until he died. And I abused and I used that man so many times. And I'm so very, very grateful that we came in the program before he did die, so I was able to make some amends to him. My mother was the real main person in my life when I was young. She used to tell me when I was a little girl how thrilled she was when she had me, because she always wanted a daughter that she could mold into a little lady. And that's exactly what my mother did for me. She always laid out my clothes for me, even until I was in high school. She told me what boys to date. She told me what classes to take. She molded every aspect of my life, and I grew up very, very dependent upon this lady. Anything that would happen that I couldn't take care of, I knew my mother would. And it took even a long time after I got into this program before, you know, I knew I had to stand on my own 2 feet. I think the first thing that I ever really did that my mother and father didn't like was when I told them I was going to marry Albert. I guess they could see the writing on the walls long before I could. As he told you, we met when we were both going to the University of Iowa. And yes, the thing about it that he didn't tell you was that the girl that he was engaged to was a very good friend of mine. And she used to tell me all about him. This young man that she was dating that was just right out of the service. And he was usually spent most of his time in the pool hall or in one of those Iowa taverns. He spent all of his money on booze or on the pool. Sometimes he would go to class. And I used to look at her and I'd shake my head and I'd think, well, you fool. I wouldn't put up with that for a minute. You know, there's all kinds of fish in the sea, and I'd go looking for another one if I were you. Well, they broke up, and I got him. And yes, he did put that ring on my finger after 3 weeks. And I've had people say to me, what in the world, why did you go out with him in the first place? And you know, above all, why did you, you know, become engaged when you knew all those things about him? And of course, retrospect is really, you know, pretty neat for all of us. And the only thing that I have been able to come up with is that I felt in Albert this great feeling that he needed me. And I think a lot of we Al-Anons fall into this trap. You know, they need us so we can take care of them. And of course, I realize now that I needed him to take care of me just as badly. Because after I had left my parents and their protection, I needed someone else, and that happened to be Albert. We were married in 1948. We do have four children. We have daughters. He's got three sons. And our life from the very start was one of traveling. It was also one of traveling and one of partying. And I have to tell you right from the very start that I love the parties. I love the drinking, and I used to drink right along with Albert. And I think, looking back, that that's one of the reasons I never wanted to call him an alcoholic. Because I always liked to, you know, to go out and order a whiskey sour on the rocks. And I loved having wine before dinner and, you know, with dinner and having people over. I enjoyed every bit of that. And I didn't want that kind of a life to stop. So I didn't want to call him an alcoholic until it got too great. I have a husband who loves to use the telephone. He always has. And, you know, I think sometimes, at least for me, I have Al-Anon antennae. Because Albert used to call us every night to say goodnight to the kids. And he'd always be so fine, but the minute that I'd get on the phone, I could sniff, you know, whether he'd be in Omaha or Scotts Bluff or wherever he would be. I knew that he'd been drinking. I knew that he was spending all that money, you know, and I knew all those things. And that's what I hated the most, was the fact, I think, that he was out there having all that good fun, and I was home having to take care of those four kids. And I used to tell him that over the phone. And invariably, either one of us would end up yelling at the other, slamming the receiver down. And I remember so many nights going into the bedroom crying and saying, he's not going to do it to me again. He's not going to be out there having all that fun. You know, he's going to have to take some responsibilities. And I'd make up such great dialogues, I think, that so many of us do about what I was going to tell him when he came home that following weekend. And, of course, I never did. I never did, and I think that's some of the insanity that I would go through, that, you know, it's going to be different, and I'm going to be different, and he's going to be different. And it never was. It never was. And I couldn't see myself getting sicker and sicker and sicker. When we moved to Westport, Connecticut, and Albert did have this fine promotion with his job, and I did find this house up in Westport that was built by an old sea captain. You know, on the outside, my life looked so great. Our four kids were happy. He had this fine job. We were living in this quaint new little New England town with all this charm, you know, and I could look right at you and I'd smile and I'd say, oh, my life is so perfect. And of course, inside it wasn't, because I was dying. I used to put him on the train when he'd commute into the city, and I never knew whether he was going to come home drunk, sober, if he was even going to come home at all. I remember two different times I went down to the airport to pick him up when he would be flying in from someplace. You know, and John, the little one, was always with me, and Albert didn't get off the plane. And there's no way you can possibly explain, you know, to a little four-year-old boy as to where your father is not. And that hole that we get right down here, you know, Tracy talked about the hole in her gut, and we Al-Anons, I think, have that same hole right here when you don't know where they are, you know. And it just became worse and worse and worse. I had a call one morning from an Episcopal priest, and he said to me, Mrs. Myers, do you know what's happened to your husband? And I said, no, where is he? And he said, he's in the hospital, and I'm not sure in what shape he's in, but I think you'd better come immediately. So I made arrangements for a babysitter, and I got the first flight, and I flew to Syracuse. The first person that I saw as I was walking down the corridor up to Albert's room was the doctor, and I said, what's wrong with my husband? And he said, and just kind of shrugged it, he said, really, there's not anything wrong with him. He just got drunk last night and hyperventilated this morning. We took him to the hospital in an ambulance. He's fine. He just needs to watch his drinking. And I want you to know I've never been full of such rage. Absolutely rage. You know, and I had to walk round and round those corridors before I could get myself under control, that I could walk in and, you know, be civil to this husband of mine who'd just been out having a good time. But I still didn't want him to stop drinking, you know. No. You know, cut it down, Albert. Use more willpower, Albert. But don't stop. It wasn't long after this when I did attempt suicide, and I did take a razor blade one morning, and I stood in the bathroom. And I really wanted to die because I just didn't know how to cope with the situation that existed. I was so far away from these parents of mine that, you know, who had taken such good care of me. And now by this time I knew there was no support, and I just didn't know what to do. And when he took me to the psychiatrist the next day, this man said to me, "Sally, you would never have gone through with it, but what you were trying to tell your husband was something has got to change. Some way your life is going to have to be different." And when we said, "Okay, we'll do whatever you decide. You tell us now, and we'll go right along with your suggestion." And he said, "I think you need to go back to Iowa. I think you need to be close to these parents of yours and get some financial stability, because really it was pretty bad." Well, it sounded great, but this was only going to be our 14th move. Roxy, by this time, had gone to 17 schools. But, you know, this time it was going to be different, because this time we were going to do what the doctor told us to. And when we got back to Iowa City, we did find this house that was just exactly what we thought we would live the rest of our lives. We were with friends that Albert had grown up with, and I was close to these ones, this mother and father of mine that loved me so much. You know, and on the outside there again, it was all so perfect. And, of course, we never, ever thought, you know, about the drinking. Albert, just use more willpower. Albert, you know, behave yourself. But never did I ever want him to stop his drinking. I got a job about that time. He didn't have one, and it does help him want to eat. And I was working. I really had no qualifications, because I had not graduated from college, and I was working at a little department store in Iowa City, wrapping packages before Christmas. And I remember how embarrassed I was and how humiliated I was about what I was doing, that I used to hide when I'd see friends of mine come in and have a present, a package wrapped. And it was all Albert's fault. You know, I could never look at myself in any part of having any part of this. It was all Albert's fault. And yet I'd have associates that I'd work at that would work with, that would look at me, and they'd say, "Sally, your life always looks so happy. You always look so serene, you know. Things that happen to you just don't seem to bother you, do they?" You know, and I'd look at them and I'd say, "Oh, no. You know, my life just couldn't be better. My husband hadn't come home the night before. We had no money. By this time, Chuck was having problems with drugs in school." But I'd look right at you and I'd say, "My life is perfect." And then I'd walk in the bathroom and I'd look at myself in the mirror, and I used to hate that person because I was such a phony. There's a gal that I heard talk a long time ago, and she said, "We Al-Anons have phony respectability." And boy, did I grab that, because that was me. I was so respectable on the outside, and I was such a lady that my mother had raised me to be. But I was such a phony on the inside that I didn't like the person that I had to look at every morning. I was so delighted when I finally got Albert to the psychiatrist, you know, where I said he had rightfully belonged. But, you know, this doctor, after Albert talked to him, then he talked to me. And I remember him. He said to me, "You realize, Sally, that you have a part in this problem." And I remember thinking, there's no way. There's just no way. You know, I was so perfect. I was a den leader. I was a Sunday school teacher. You know, everything I could do to make Albert look bad, I would. But this doctor had the audacity to tell me, you know, that I had a part in this problem. And he said, "You're not responsible for Albert's drinking, but what you are responsible for is your own behavior. And you need to learn to keep your mouth shut." Oh, let me tell you, I never would talk to you, because my mother always said, you know, you never tell what's going on outside your walls, what's going on within the walls. But I sure told Albert. Everything that he did, every little minute detail, you know, he knew, because I told him. And when the doctor said, "You need to learn to keep your mouth shut," it was the hardest thing I ever did in my life. But it worked. It worked. And I always tell the new ones when they come in the program, learn to keep your mouth shut. You know, it does help. The kids did leave when they would graduate from high school, and of course to me it was always Albert's fault. It was still Albert that all had all the problems. And I prided myself on the fact that I was such a good mother. The fact that I was doing things that I couldn't remember until years later. We were with Roxy came to visit us a few years ago. And I made some statement to her about that I always prided myself on the fact that I never badmouthed her father to her, or to the boys. I always, you know, didn't hold Albert up as an example, but I just never told her all the things he did. And she gave me kind of a funny look, and she said, "Mama, what do you think you were doing all those nights when you sit by my bed and you tell me all the things that Daddy would do?" She The thing we could never understand is that you could get up the next morning and you'd act like nothing was ever wrong. And I didn't remember any of those things. And a couple of years ago, we were in Chicago with the children off for Christmas. And I said something about I was so tickled and so gratified that Albert was never physical with me, because that was one of the things that I never could have stood. And Tom looked at me and he said, "Well, of course, Mom, that's because you were the one who was physical with Dad." No way. No way. You know, I'm such a lady. And Tom said, "Don't you remember throwing a lamp at him? Don't you remember hitting him as hard as you could? You know, with your hands?" And I said, "No." Now, this is 2 years ago, and we'll be in the program 15 years in September. And I had to come back to Dallas, and I had to do a lot of soul searching. And I remember now throwing a lamp at Albert, one of my good lamps, too. And I can remember now standing up, you know, nose to nose, hitting him as hard as I could, you know, on his chest. If I could have killed him, I think I would have, in frustration. But it took me, you see, 13 years and a son to remind me of those things. So I'm not quite sure what God has in store yet for me, but I hope I've grown enough in the program that I can accept what I did way back when. I can recall now breaking a hairbrush over Johnny, spanking him in frustration, you know, of something that their father did. And of course, I couldn't punish him. Then I wonder why John's had problems. There's a little pamphlet that we have in Al-Anon about children. And the first time I ever read it, I was just devastated, because it talks about how the spouse of the alcoholic is the one who does most of the damage to the children. And I thought, "Oh God, what have I done to my kids?" Because they have all had their problems. And then I heard an alcoholic woman talk, and she said, "Each one of us does the very, very best we can at every single point in our life. And it's okay now, because I know that I was the very best mother I could have been. And it's all right. And I've made my amends to my children. And when I sat down with them, each one of them said, 'It's okay, Mom. We could see how sick you were. And forget it.' You know, and that's neat inside. And I'm so grateful for that. We did lose the house. We had to have the auction of our furniture out in the front yard. And it was probably one of the lowest points in my life, because some of those things that were auctioned off were wedding presents. There was a set of Haviland china that had been my great-grandmother's, had been a wedding present to she and my great-grandfather. And she used to tell me about it when I was a little girl, how it was to go to her daughter, you know, and all passed on down the line. And it was one of the things we lost. I had a big white colonial dollhouse that I had given to Roxy. And to show you where I was at that time, where my focus was, after we'd come in the program, Roxy one time mentioned, she said, "Mama, do you know how hard it was when I lost that dollhouse?" She said, "I always wanted to keep it for my daughter." And I said, "No, I had never thought about Roxy and her feelings." By that time, my focus was so much on their father and what he was doing to me and how he was affecting my life that I didn't think about my kids. I was a good mother because my mother had told me to be a good mother, functionally. But I realize emotionally now how much I crippled them. We did move to Freeport in 1972. John went with us, and that's because he was the only one at home at the time. And it was a year of just existing long before I found the program. It was a year when I didn't know where Albert was most of the time. And it was a year of living one day at a time. I've got to stop and tell you that this daddy of mine, and Albert didn't mention it, this father of mine that I loved so much and that was so good to me, came into the program in 1952, and he had over 25 years of continuous sobriety before he died. And I'm so grateful that I said that I could make my amends to him. And he and Mother sent me some literature when I was in Shreveport. Or when I was in Westport and I was having so many problems and I was tempted to suicide. I can't tell you whether I read it or not. I do not know. I do remember sending a friend of mine to Al-Anon in Iowa City because she needed to go. I don't know why I didn't go with her, but you see, I was still right along at the same time. I was still drinking with Albert. I was I've always had a very deep faith in God, and I'm very grateful for that. I know that someplace I'd put him back there, you know. But I used to talk to him. And every day when I'd go to work, I'd put my hand out and I'd put it in God's hands. And I still do that to this very day. And this one particular morning, I turned off the radio in the car and I said, "Okay, God, I've had as much as I can handle with Albert Myers. God, you're going to have to take over. And God, I expect something to happen." And to show you that miracles do happen, it was the very next night that Albert was arrested for his DWI and put in jail. I agree. We went to our first AA meeting the very next night at the Southfield Group, St. Paul's Church in Shreveport, and I have said from the very start, and I believe it forever, that it was an instant love affair because you all lifted us up and you loved and you hugged us and you started us on a road to recovery. And it's a never-ending road, and it's a road that I just absolutely cherish. You are it. You know, this is the way of life, and it's the only way of life. I can't tell you much about Al-Anon those first 3 months when we were in Shreveport. The thing I remember most was seeing the smiles on people's faces. You know, and the hope that you gave me. Because in my life by that time was so grim and so miserable that I didn't think there was any hope for anything. But you all said there was, Sally. And you all said that, you know, one day at a time, if you work this program as we tell you to, you know, you can find the life that you've always wanted. So we started working those steps. And we started doing the things you told us. And in December of that year, we went to Dallas. And we literally didn't know anybody when we came into Dallas. Now, I mean that. And we were two very, very frightened people. John, as Albert told you, had to stay in Shreveport because he was so bitterly unhappy with both of us. And it wasn't only his daddy that he kept the loaded shotgun for. Many mornings I would walk in a room and I'd start to say something to John. And he'd put his hand on that shotgun and he'd say, "What do you want, Mother?" You know, no love at all in his voice or in his eyes for me. And it's taken a long, long time in this program, you know, to reestablish any kind of a bond with John. But you told us when we came to Dallas that the first thing we needed to do was to find a meeting, and that's what we started doing. We went to one meeting, and then we went to another and another, looking for that place that we could call home. And God has always worked such beautiful miracles for me, because one morning, on a Saturday morning, Albert and I were taking some clothes to a cleaner's not far from where he worked. And as we pulled up, I happened to notice the AA logo on the door, right next to the cleaners. And I said, "Look, Albert, there's an AA club. Let's go upstairs and find out what it's like." When we walked upstairs that Saturday morning, we found a club called Alpha. And I have to tell you what Alpha was. It had been formed about 6 months prior to that by 40 people, couples, who wanted a club, a family club, where they could work out family problems, where they could work out problems of marriage, with children, you know. And this is exactly what Albert and I needed. Because this beautiful old man, that was his first sponsor in Shreveport, he and his wife had shown us by example that, yes, you could put your marriages back together if you tried. So Alpha was exactly the right thing for us. And we jumped in with both feet, and I found a sponsor who loved me enough to tell me, you know, to get off my duff and start working the program. You know, who still does that today. And Albert found a sponsor that told him the same thing, you know. And we started mutually working the steps in our marriage to try and rebuild it, as he said, one 2x4 at a time. It hasn't always been easy. And it still isn't easy to this day, but it's so worthwhile. And I know I mentioned her today, but we heard a lady at one of our very first conferences, and we heard her say that each one of us must give the other person the dignity to do what he asked to do. And I remember Albert and I, as we were coming home from that conference, we said, "Wouldn't that be great if we could do that in our marriage? You know, if I can't just let Albert be Albert." Well, that's tough. But I still want him to do what I want him to do. My very favorite slogan or saying that I've ever heard in this program in almost 15 years is by Winnie Eddy. from California, and she said she knew she couldn't make her husband stop drinking, but she sure as hell wished he'd mind. And I know what she means, you know. I want my husband, my kids, all of you to mind. It's hard to give up those controls. And we Elnas love to control, or maneuver, or manipulate, or whatever you call it. But it works, and you know, I'm so grateful that I have a husband now who lets me be me. I can get up in the morning and not be in a good place and say, okay, I need this space, and he'll step back and let me have that space. There are times I want him to get right down there with me, but he knows better, and he lets me work out of the pain that I'm in, you know, and thank goodness for that. Our four kids that gradually had left us had gradually come back. At first Roxy came, and Roxy and I always maintained a relationship. So she came back to see us and spent Thanksgiving with us after we've been in the program a couple of years. And then it was sort of like a scouting party because she went out and she told Tom, you know, why don't you go see them? They're not so bad. So Tom came the following year for Mother's Day, and then Chuck came, and then, of course, John was living with us. We've been in the program for a little over 4 years, and Roxy called and said, we'd all like to be with you for Christmas. And that year, see your four children, complete with one grandchild at the time, sitting around the Christmas table. You know, that's when you knew that what you were doing was okay. That's when you knew that this program worked. You know, and it was peace on earth, believe me. Roxy is a very special lady. She and her husband and her two little boys live in Chicago. She's going through the battle of suburbia. She loves Al-Anon. I'm sorry, Vinoy is going to adult children of alcoholics. But she calls it adult children of Al-Anon, so I guess it's okay. And Vinoy knows her and knows what a special gal she is. She was down in Dallas just this last weekend, and Monday night I took her to a meeting, and I just sat in awe listening to my daughter talking about getting out of the problem and getting into the solution, you know, and so proud. I'm so proud of her and what she said. Many times she calls me and she'll say, Mama, I'm having such and such a problem. What step do I use with it? So I know that she's using her problem in Chicago. She loves to go to conferences with us. I think if she could have, she'd be here with us this weekend. The least little thing is she's got a neat husband who lets her come and go with us, and I'm so grateful for him. We did have her oldest son with us all last week. We needed to come here, believe me. We're not used to being grandparents for a concentrated period of a time, and you know, your privacy is invaded, and you know, it was a real education for both of us. We went to the circus and to the zoo and to the rodeo. I cooked like I haven't cooked for years, but it was so worthwhile. And how nice to know that he wanted to come spend the time with us. That was the best part of it. And he said to me just before he left, Grandma, can I come back next year? And I said, Corey, you can come back and stay anytime. And I meant it. Our middle son, Tom, lives in Austin now. He's with Texas Instruments. And I say this, I think he has a problem. I see the pain in Tom, and I've heard him talk after he's been out partying with his friends. Tom is the only one of our four children who is the one who would come up to me as a small child and put his arms around me and say, I love you, Mom, without being coaxed. He's been one of my four children whom I never, ever thought I needed to worry about. And isn't it strange that he's the one that I think has a problem? And I want to pick him up bodily and bring him here and say, here, Tom, here is where you belong. And I know I can. You know, and it hurts inside. And I've talked around and in and about. And as a mother, it's very hard for me to keep my mouth shut, as the doctor told me so long ago, but I know I have to. I know I have to let you all work in his life and let God work in his life. and that'll be much more successful than I am. Our youngest son, John, has been the bane of my existence for years. He, I think, probably has suffered more with the disease of alcoholism than all the other children. As I told you, he's the one that I broke the hairbrush over. He's the one that I took out so many of my feelings on because I couldn't control his father. John moved to New York, and then he came back to Dallas, and he's now back in New York. We hear from him very, very seldom. And as his mother, my expectations are, why doesn't he call? Why doesn't he write? Where is John? What's he doing? And Roxy had to tell me just again last week, Mother, stop expecting things from John. Don't forget, he's untreated alcoholism. I don't think John has a problem with drinking at all, but I can see every other ism possible in his existence, you know? So I have to just let John be John. Our oldest son, Chuck, because he was the oldest son, he was the one that we wanted to participate in every sport imaginable. He had to play Little League football and Little League baseball and, you know, basketball, anything he could do. Albert and I both pushed him because I love sports of all kinds and I wanted to be down in the front row, you know, urging him on. But Chuck did get into trouble with drugs when he was in high school. So one day when I had a call from the guidance counselor, I wasn't really very surprised. And when I got up there, this man said to me, Mrs. Myers, do you realize what you're doing to your son? He is not an athlete of any kind. He is not a football player. He really doesn't play basketball well, and certainly he isn't a baseball player. What he is, he's a poet, he's a writer, and he's really a very accomplished artist. Why don't you leave him alone and let him do what he wants to do? Well, I walked away from there thoroughly indignant. I am his mother. How dare this man say this to me? But because at this time I was blaming everything on Albert, I went home and I picked up the phone and I said, Albert, do you realize what you're doing to your son? When Chuck graduated from high school, he left us every way possible, physically, emotionally, spiritually. There was just, we did not see or hear from Chuck. He was living in a shack on the Isle River. And we took some Christmas presents to him, and when we knocked on the door and he opened it, he saw who it was. He turned his back on us because he didn't want any part of his mother or his father. He was married and divorced by the time he was 19, and he had a little girl by that marriage. He has another daughter by a woman he was never married to. And his lifestyle was one that I did not understand because, after all, I had not raised my son to be anything like what Chuck was doing. And I was just lost. I didn't know how to communicate. And the only way we kept any knowledge of Chuck at all was through Roxy. And she did, you know, keep the communication lines open with Chuck. He did graduate from the University of Iowa with a degree in art. He really is a very fine artist. He came to Austin, Texas, and he was working on his master's degree. And very gradually, Chuck would come to see us. And it wasn't because he wanted to, I know that now. It was because of the pressure from his brothers and his sister. We're all going to be there, Chuck, and you need to come too. So Chuck would come. But it was never, excuse me, it was never voluntary. I'd go to bed every night and I'd always pray as I would for my children. You know, God, what can I do to reestablish a relationship with Chuck? There's a prayer that's in the fifth chapter in the big book. That's the third step prayer, and it's a prayer that Albert and I say together every morning. It says, God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. This one particular night, I prayed as I always did, okay, God, please help me with Chuck. Please, God. You know, I need something, God. And I heard from someplace, and I don't know where, God, I offer Chuck to thee. to build with him and to do with him as thou wilt. Relieve him of the bondage of self, that he may better do thy will. Take away his difficulties. I heard the whole third step prayer with Chuck in the third person. And when I woke up the next morning, it was okay, because what I had done was put Chuck in God's hands, you know, and I felt all right. About 3 weeks later, Chuck called, and he said, could I come and spend the weekend with you? I said, Chuck, we'd love to have you. And when Chuck walked in the door that following Saturday morning, he was carrying a suit. Now, you just got to believe me, Chuck is not into suits. And I guess I had my motherly look on my face because he said, could I go to church with you and Dad tomorrow morning? I said, no, we'd love to have you, Chuck. There'd be nothing but make us happier. And we're Episcopalians, and the next day as we were kneeling in church, Chuck put his hand on mine. And he said, Mom, I know it's been over 15 years since I've been in church with you and Dad. And there was a cross right in front of me, and I looked up, and I said, thank you, Father. And thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, because certainly without it, you know, I would never have had my son there with me. Now, this isn't to say that Chuck has always had things go his way. As Albert told you, he has not. And there are times when I just, you know, die inside because my kids are so precious to me, and I have to use my program so much with them, you know. But I know what I can do. I can once again offer Chuck to thee. And when I do it, it helps. It's that constant reaffirming that I know I have to do. But you know, when things seem to go along sort of okay, I forget. I don't pray nearly as hard as when all of a sudden there's a problem. You know, I know I'm so grateful, I guess, for one thing that this program has given to me, and that's, you know, that fact I need my meetings, I need the people, I need the constant affirmations of good, positive solutions and not stay in the problem. My thinking was so negative for so many years. My cup was always half empty. I used to get so mad at Albert because he was such a cockeyed optimist, you know, and I always was such a pessimist, you know, and I am slowly, very slowly getting to the point that now my cup is half full. It's not half empty anymore. Thank God for that. Albert did have his heart attack, and within a matter of hours after he had it, my program went right down the drain. I was scared. I didn't know how to handle the situation. What am I going to do when he comes home? What did I do to cause it? So many of the same feelings that I had during the act of drinking came right back with his heart attack. And I was told I needed to go home, and what I needed to do was sit down and work the 12 steps with Albert and his heart problems. You know, exactly like I had done with every other area. And I have come to this conclusion, and I know it's so right for me, that there is nothing anymore that can happen to me. The 12 steps of this program don't work. You know, they do work. And I'm so grateful for that because I have needed them time and time again. It was the middle of March. Roxy called one morning and she said, Mama, we know that your and Daddy's 40th anniversary is coming up in June, and we would really like to do something, you know, the boys and I. You and Dad sit down and talk it over, and you let us know. Well, Albert and I talked it over. We decided we didn't want a party. We just really, what we would like to do was to have all four of our kids, just kids, no grandchildren, no in-laws, no nothing, you know, just our four children. So they made arrangements, and on the weekend of the 19th of June, we all met in Austin, which is where Tom and Chuck both live. Roxy from Chicago and John from New York. And you know, you can imagine the reminiscing and the laughter and the giggling and the, do you remember when? And gosh, remember how they acted and all the things that we talked about. But the night of our anniversary, when they toasted us, happy 40th anniversary, Mom and Dad. These were the four kids that, you know, 15 years before that didn't want to spend one minute with us. You can imagine the gratitude that I had for Alcoholics Anonymous, the love that I have for Al-Anon, the love and gratitude I have for all of you and what you have given to me. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.